Hello, and welcome to Ask Dr. Dawn. The opinions expressed in this program are those of the speakers, and this is a program intended for education and entertainment. It should not be construed as a substitute for a medical consultation. Well, I am going to dedicate the first half of this program to taking a more nuanced view of GLP-1 medications. I've always had a rather good opinion of these for, well, many years, since a patient of mine with type 2 diabetes began on them about 10 years ago. And I hadn't, he had left the area, and I went to visit his family and saw him, and he had lost a lot of weight, and I obviously didn't know what his medications were, and he told me, and I was like, oh, all right, I've heard of that. And I have to acknowledge, at that point, it was like every year or less, there was a new diabetes drug. They were just like popping up like mushrooms in January. And a lot of them worked, like Starlix, for example. A lot of them worked by beating on the pancreas. Thalidomides did that. They make the pancreas work harder, right, and put out more insulin. But of course, the problem with type 2 diabetes is that the cells are becoming insensitive to insulin. So yeah, putting out more insulin lowers the blood sugar for a while, but it also increases the insulin resistance. And so you're on the primrose path to having to take insulin when your pancreas finally collapses in exhaustion. And so I didn't really know that much about this particular drug. I believe it was Victoza that he was on. But I was impressed by the weight loss, and I began, and his wife told me, yeah, now that he's lost weight, you know, he's just gotten religion about what he eats, and he's biking to work, and he's eating so much less garbage. And our friend re-stabilized at a newer and much healthier level. So fast forward to about 4 years ago, when the Marilyn Monroe moment arrived at the famous dinner that they do in New York. I forget, it's some sort of art league, but art institute or whatever, but everybody who's anybody shows up for that. And one very powerful influencer showed up wearing a dress that she had purchased that had originally belonged to Marilyn Monroe in a movie. And of course, she told all the people about it. And the fact that she'd been able to fit into the dress because she was taking, I think it was semaglutide Ozempic. And it just, all the influencers all over the internet jumped on it. And it felt very much at that moment like a cosmetic drug, and one that, you know, because it was so expensive and only covered for diabetics, was something that the elite could play with. It created, I think, kind of a cognitive backlash, at least in my mind and in the minds of many physicians. I think the behavioral weight loss programs around that time began to take a very big hit. Many closed down. But I'm seeing a resurgence now of what I'm going to call multimodal weight loss programs that include both the judicious use of these agents, the GLP-1 inhibitors, and behavioral change and group support. And I want to encourage that. Like everything else in society right now, opinions are polarized, defensive, and righteous on this issue. On one side stand those who view GLP-1 receptor agonists as capitulation, the pharmaceutical industry's latest argument that biology trumps behavior, that the hard work of lifestyle medicine can be chemically bypassed. On the other hand, there are those who see these medications as a gift, a tool powerful enough to finally give patients the metabolic footing they need to actually do the work. And I want to spend some time tonight talking about that metabolic footing and bringing you some recent stuff out of Nature and Science magazines, researching the phenomenon, not the GLP-1s directly, but tying into what I'm about to say. So this debate itself represents a false dichotomy. It's been long hampered in clinical medicine. We don't argue We don't argue that antihypertensives undermine lifestyle intervention for hypertension. Ideally, at least my philosophy, is we use them to reduce acute cardiovascular risk while we build the behavioral scaffolding that may eventually replace them entirely or at least allow us to lower the dose and not progress to yet to a second and then a third drug, which is exactly what happens if we don't fix the lifestyle. We don't treat statin therapy as incompatible with the Mediterranean diet. We're like, yeah, use them together, then you can take a lower dose of statins. Yet, I think with obesity, there's this kind of puritanical, moralistic frame that insists that behavior change must be earned, not enabled. I don't know, it's kind of crazy. Belly fat produces over 17 different hormones. It's not a calorie storage. It's an organ. And it's an organ that wants to grow. Once it starts growing, it releases compounds that do a number of things. And one of them is in pretty much guarantee that it will keep growing in that particular environment. And that environment includes what the person's eating. It includes what other comorbidities the person has, what their exercise is like, what their stress is like, what their sleep is like, all the things that lifestyle medicine really focus on, belly fat torpedoes them, seriously. Leptin, for example, belly fat produces the satiety hormone, but the heavier you are, the more satiety hormone you produce, right? You shouldn't want to eat more, but in fact, this leptin hormone, too much of it, just like too much insulin, leads to receptor resistance. So most people, if they get to the point of being obese, actually their satiety response is blunted and they may not feel full when they're full. And they may not feel full, if they do ever feel full, for very long. Belly fat also, visceral adipose tissue, produces interleukin-6, which is a pro-inflammatory cytokine. Goes skyrockets when you get COVID, for example, or other bad viral infections like flu. Tumor necrosis factor alpha blocks insulin, also produced by belly fat. Blocking insulin increases insulin resistance. There's also a lovely hormone that I'd never heard of before called resistin. And resistin isn't so named because it increases insulin resistance, but also it's a pro-inflammatory agent. And then there's plasminogen activator inhibitor 2. This causes increased clotting and decreased melting of clots, which is really important. Plasminogen helps... I won't go into the blood clotting cycle. It's bloody complicated. But the clots are constantly being formed and broken down, and that they're in balance, rather like the bone balance. If you mess with the balance and the clots don't melt spontaneously and pretty darn quickly, you can get emboli and you can get heart attacks. So this is the PAI-1 is the thing that is associated with the increased cardiovascular risk and stroke risk that goes along for the ride with obesity. There's also one called retinol binding protein number 4. That decreases the ability of muscle to absorb and use glucose. Well, if you can't get glucose into your muscles, guess what? It's harder to exercise. Your muscles feel weak and you get tired more readily. So good, you don't burn so many of those excess calories and the belly fat gets what it wants, which is to grow. There's also one called Clemerin. This summons inflammatory cells like macrophages into the fat. It also increases inflammatory mediators and increases fat accumulation in the belly. Therefore, fat that might have gone somewhere else goes to the belly. As we age, you may have noticed you lose fat in your face and gain it below the belly button. Well, there is a method to that. I'm not sure what it is, but certainly the belly fat is a self-perpetuating cycle. There's also bisphatin, which modulates glucose metabolism, breaks it down more slowly so it hangs around longer. It's also pro-inflammatory. And then there's adiponectin. That's the only thing that goes down in that belly fat produces. And you want as much adiponectin as you can get because it increases insulin sensitivity. It suppresses gluconeogenesis, which is where the liver makes extra glucose overnight and you wake up with a high blood sugar even though you haven't eaten anything. You ever wonder about that? Yeah, that's why. It's the liver. It increases, these are all good things. You want less gluconeogenesis. You want increased fatty oxidation so you can burn that fat and use it for energy. It decreases inflammation. It blocks interleukin 6. Well, what can I say except that there's not much good to say about belly fat. We want to lower it and stop this vicious cycle. Once the cycle is set into motion, it really has a will of its own, and it has momentum. And it's foolish to apply a moral judgment about willpower because the gut brain has gone rogue. So what's going on neurobiologically with the GLP-1 agonists? GLP-1 receptors are expressed in the pancreatic cells, the beta cells, and in the GI tract, but they're all over the nervous system, the hypothalamus, the brainstem, the hippocampus, the mesolimbic reward system. And the pharmacological activation of these receptors does something really profound. It quiets what many people call food noise. It lowers the salience of food. The salience network in the brain is one of the three main centers of processing that happens sort of below the level of consciousness. If you walk by something and it pings at you and you turn and see it, you recognize someone, you see something in a store window that you've been searching for, you see a $100 bill on the sidewalk, your salience network spotted it and brought it to your attention because it has all of these things that it's watching for. And in the case of obesity, the salience network is basically hyper-tuned to see food and bring it to your attention. So you're 10 feet away from a baby eating an ice cream cone, and you're like on the ice cream cone. That's a detail in the environment you don't need to even be looking at. But with your salience network tuned to food, that's exactly what happens. These drugs act on the salient network and allow people to ignore food, ignore it when it's not, when they're not hungry. And when they're hungry, the salience network turns back up somewhat, but the drugs are suppressing it. And I'm sure you've noticed, if you are really hungry or fasting, there's a period of time, maybe the first 18 to 24 hours, where the smell of food becomes more intense. The salience network is like, hey, you, get something to eat. Less salient food is one of the big reasons that people taking these lose weight. Another reason is that their taste buds shift, and the sweet and salty tastes that are sort of hardwired into us to be things to crave, we stop craving them, and we don't notice taste as strongly, and it turns off the reward circuits. Let's take it from a behavioral science perspective for a moment, because this matters enormously. Behavioral science says self-determination theory holds that durable behavior change requires three conditions: autonomy, a sense that change is self-directed, not coerced; competence, the experience of actually succeeding. I want to emphasize that, the experience of actually succeeding; and relatedness, connection to others who support the change. For patients whose cognitive bandwidth has been monopolized by food-related preoccupation, none of these conditions can fully take root. The GLP medications, by quieting the salience network, by quieting that preoccupation, they don't replace behavioral medicine. But what they do is they create psychological space for it, and they create an environment where success is likely to happen. Because remember what they said in that conditions, experience of success, the experience of actually succeeding, is critical to being able to change your behavior. GLP can be a psychological catalyst for habit change. A catalyst, in a chemical sense, lowers the activation energy required for a reaction to proceed. It doesn't change the reaction, only the threshold at which it becomes possible. So GLP-1 creates a window of opportunity for meaningful change. And that window stays open for a while. But without meaningful change in behavior, you don't create a self-sustaining environment in the opposite direction. We're going to be diving into a little bit of the science of that. But the point is, this allows for the autonomy, the experience of actually succeeding, and the behavioral change that can be persistent. You need to be in a group. You need to, it could be a Zoom group. It could be a once a week meeting. But we are group animals. We are not isolated animals. And so we entrain each other and co-create when we're working in a group towards a common goal. We co-create an environment that sustains successful change. So how long do people stay on the drugs? Well, less than a year, actually, even when they're covered by insurance for weight loss. The lowest engagement quartile in various studies can be as little as 3 or 4 months. Now, there are GI side effects. They're not severe, but you have to be motivated to get past them if you get them. But people who are in who were in a group and were engaged in it doubled the time that they stayed on the medication. And these are preliminary studies, and they are soft science in the sense they're observational. They're really not blinded at all, which of course makes it soft science as far as the hardcore people are concerned. But when you discontinue, the majority of the weight is lost within months of stopping them because with absent durable behavior change. And the problem is that just behavioral change alone fails to overcome the neuroendocrine resistance. And so you don't get far enough along to shift all of those changes in the visceral fat and all of those hormones and all of that stuff that's going on in the brain. In one study that was done at Tufts, patients who achieved 10% or greater body weight loss and then discontinued were followed for 4 months. The people who had been enrolled in a behavioral support program had about 3 times less weight gain compared to the usual care. And they also outperformed a third group, which was medically tailored meals, which is where you're going to eat the meals we give you and you sign a paper agreeing to that. And yeah, good luck with compliance on that. The key with behavioral programs is the continuing engagement in a group format with the person who is trying to lose weight. And that's what made Weight Watchers and other programs work. What made them work was that showing up every week and being weighed in and getting and having people cheer you on and getting a little pin. I mean, these things were obviously based on 12-step programs. The early Weight Watchers clearly was. But it worked. And I think my mother, who was an introvert and not a very social person, although she was a very kind woman, lost over 100 pounds on Weight Watchers back when I was a teenager. I was basically cooking the Weight Watchers meals for her because she was working. And I have to say that high vegetable, low starch, low sugar kind of approach probably shaped my behavior in a way that allowed me to avoid most of my life, to actually maintain a healthy body weight, which is, believe me, not a familial trait. So the combination: pharmacology that changes the biological terrain and behavioral scaffolding that builds durable habits is the clear winner on how to help people succeed. I think we need to stop treating GLP co-prescription as a clinical compromise and start treating it as a precision decision, one informed by the patient's neuroendocrine phenotype. By the way, all of those kinds that I talked about in the first part of this can be measured. What about their history with successful or unsuccessful behavioral intervention? And what about the environmental barriers? A spouse who's afraid if his wife becomes too attractive, he'll lose her. Children who act as distractors or who just demand to have stuff around the house that makes it harder for the person to avoid snacking. And the change in dietary habits is key. Back after the Marilyn Monroe dress incident, I gave a couple of talks at the Healthy Way here in Santa Cruz about this. And I tried to emphasize to people that the diet that feeds a healthy microbiome, that is to say, higher fiber, fruits and vegetables, guys, lower sugar, that option is made a lot easier when you can't even taste the sugar. And the changes in the brain and the salience network mean that you don't get if you cheat and have the ice cream, it's like, you don't get the dopamine burst that it used to give you. You don't get the kick. And once the microbiome reshapes to bacteria that prefer fiber and sugar and fiber and less sugar and fat, the gut brain has new programming and, you know, a new set of supervisory bugs that are going to hand down edicts to the brain to choose that food, select that food, and not really eat more of that one because, yeah. You've got it. The microbiome, once reshaped, can help you retain the behavior. As the weight drops, also, it's easier to ramp up the daily exercise, which is a core part of lifestyle medicine, a core part of the new sustaining behaviors. From exercise comes more muscle mass. Muscle mass reduces insulin resistance. The satiety response returns to normal because as you lose that, as you gain muscle and lose fat, you stop making as much leptin, and your normal leptin spikes in response to a meal start to have salience again and kick off the satiety. So there is nothing that is shameful or bad about taking advantage of this pharmacology. But if you start it, first of all, for many people, there's a financial investment. You also need to make the lifestyle investment, or you may very well be just adding to the yo-yo that you've been on for years already. But the changes are simple and they're doable, and joining a group is easier and easier. Many insurances will pay for these groups for people who have obesity. Medicare secondary Medigap policies will pay for this because it is in very much the insurance company's interest to not have to pay for all of the other things that they will be paying for if you continue on the vector that you're on as an older diabetic person or pre-diabetic person or obese person. Sleep apnea and hypertension are also factors, both of which are made great. They're diagnoses, right? You can eliminate those diagnoses with weight loss. You can cure them. So now we're getting into, hey, maybe this actually causes another few pharmaceuticals and a cumbersome apparatus on your face every night to disappear. It's a huge shift in how we address a major health problem. And I'm very excited and hopeful that it's going to go somewhere really good. Okay, so obesity drugs, this is from Nature, November 2025. Obesity drugs quiet food noise in the brain. Here's how. So food noise is defined in this article as intrusive, compulsive thoughts about eating. And the researchers measured electrical signals in the brain of a person who had experienced this after the person began taking the medication. This study was the first to use electrodes to directly measure how blockbuster obesity drugs that mimic the hormone GLP-1 affect brain activity in people, and to hint at how they might curb extreme food cravings. Now, this was a piggyback on an existing study. A guy named Casey Halpern, a neurosurgeon scientist at University of Penn in Philadelphia, were investigating the effects, did not set out to investigate obesity drugs. Their goal was to test whether a type of deep brain stimulation, which is a therapy involved delivering a weak electrical signal directly into the brain, could help reduce compulsive eating for people with whom bariatric surgery hadn't worked. So they'd already had essentially a gastric bypass, and they hadn't gotten any better. Scientists set up a study in which participants had an electrode implanted into their nucleus accumbens, which is a region in the brain that's tied with feelings of reward. This type of electrode could record electrical activity and deliver an electric current, and it's already used to treat people with some forms of epilepsy. The way that works is when it detects a certain pattern of electrical activity in the brain, it changes it. It sort of interferes with it to keep it from gaining momentum and causing a seizure. For the study's first two participants, the researchers found that episodes of intense food noise were accompanied by a surge in low-frequency brain activity in the nucleus accumbens. And they thought, well, this could serve as a measurable sign of compulsive food cravings. And their third trial participant had just started taking a high dose of tirzepatide, which is Wegovy and Zepbound, and which had been prescribed by her physician to treat her type 2 diabetes. And so they followed her, and while taking the drug, that particular person's compulsions to binge eat vanished, and it was very striking to see that the food noise, the activity that had previously been seen in the nucleus accumbens, was just silent compared to the other two people. And what they found over time was a certain wearing off of the effect in her, and so that's the findings of that particular study, is it lasted for less than a year. And of course, this is a person who'd already had had many, many treatments and many strategies tried before they could qualify for a gastric bypass, and still was having difficulty. So an unfortunate person. This other study was looking at the RNA sequencing in adipose tissue and in the surrounding tissues. So they were characterizing the changes in adipose tissue after bariatric surgery and comparing that to a lean control group. Let's start off with just telling you that adipose tissue is not just a bag of fat cells. You have the adipocytes, which can be flaccid or they can be filled with fat. Your adipocytes, the total number you have in your life is established in childhood. So overfeeding, basically what we know just from epidemiology is that if you have a very frail, thin baby and you feed it up, really, you know, maybe even overfeed the baby to a certain extent because of concerns about making sure they gain weight, they will have more adipocytes, so they'll essentially have more places to store fat in their body. But adipose tissue also has blood vessels and nerves. It has anti-inflammatory macrophages, which keep inflammation down, and this is in lean, healthy body weight people. When you get into obesity, you get inflammation. We've already talked about that. And those macrophages actually shift their genetics or their epigenetics, and they become pro-inflammatory. And the inflammation, the adipose tissues, a lot of those adipokines I was talking about, are coming from the macrophages. And they're a defense that doesn't need to be mounted. But inflammatory fat is harder to mobilize, and so it's harder for the body to actually burn inflamed fat. And you also see senescent adipocytes that are showing extreme old age changes in obesity, and that includes a lower number of mitochondria, and they're sort of hibernating. And they don't have normal physiology anymore. After the weight loss with the tissue, you see decreased inflammation, decreased senescence, and fewer stress cells. And this is all in like biopsy stuff. So this was what they were interested in, is what's going on genetically. And so they analyzed the transcriptional profiles of adipose tissues from 25 individuals with obesity before and several months after. And they obtained data from 24 lean individuals who'd never been obese. And what they found was that several cell types in what they called the fat depot, including the adipocytes, but also stromal cells, which are the connective tissue cells, and the vascular cells, express a specific portfolio of genes associated with various types of cellular stress. So they're already sort of primed, if you will, to stress out just at baseline in even the lean individuals. And in the case, as they looked at the genetics, they found that this senescent pattern was had a particular fingerprint, and that as it disappeared, the inflammation went down, but not entirely. There were some persistent changes in the epigenome, and particularly in the areas mentioned in that inflammatory depot. So the transcriptional changes persisted. I don't know how long they ran this study, but then they pivoted to talking about mice, and what they found was that these lipid-associated inflammatory macrophages drop with weight loss, and yet they keep some of their old epigenetics. And this is, again, in mice, and this would be a longer-term study relative to the life of a mouse. What it means is something I've observed myself, which is if a person has been obese, they need to be vigilant. And that's why the lifestyle changes and the group support is so important, because it is a slippery slope. And what I think I see as the GLP-1s long-term looking like is if you start to slide, you go back on them, get yourself back a little margin, and then double down on the behavior and stop the GLP-1 drugs. And that would be a sustainable way to fight against that epigenetic shift. So I'm hoping that we see something like that happening. I'm hoping for a real change, because we have a real epidemic going on here and it needs to be addressed. I'd like to see many, many more behavioral programs. I'd like to see every hospital and large multi-specialty clinic have a program like this. And I think now that Medicare may actually be paying for it, that will give the financial incentive for these to be developed and then opened up to the general public. And I think it could be really transformational, not just for weight, but for all the things, the cancer, the arthritis, the 99 things that primary care doctors see over and over and over again. So many of them are lifestyle related, not genetic, not acquired through infection. It would be just amazing if we could transform our health system by moving in this direction. All right. Enough daydreaming. So email, what is the current long-term knowledge we have on smoking versus vaping? I was really happy to see this question. We can't know the long-term risk. Because if there's no long-term data. Short-term, it's better than cigarettes, but it's still an issue. It's still a problem. E-cigarettes contain nicotine, propylene glycol, reactive oxygen species, nitrosamines, which are carcinogens, and metals. And people who vape have lower less good spirometry. If they don't have chronic obstructive pulmonary disease, vaping will give them the readings on a spirometry of someone with mild COPD. If they already have COPD, vaping doesn't make them worse, which I find very interesting, and it suggests that it's acting as an irritant and causing the airways to close down. coronary artery disease, vaping for more than a year increases the relative risk for stroke by 1.62, and the risk doesn't quite double the risk for MI. And of course, this is epidemiologic data, probably mainly looking at people who started vaping, but I don't know that for a fact. I think it's are you now a vapor versus are you now a smoker? So some of that could have been people who switched to vaping thinking it was healthier, and maybe it was, but not enough. Stop. And big time, don't smoke and vape. Smoking and vaping have a multiplicative effect. It's way worse than just smoking. Let's go with something really kind of cool. The world's first cockroach diving suit actually works. A cyborg cockroach survived up to 3 hours underwater with an experimental new oxygen tank. So what the heck, cyborg? Imagine a scenario, okay? There's an earthquake. You're trapped in the basement of the building. The pipes are broken, and you're lying in a pool of water. The stairway is full of debris. The elevators are full of debris. You don't know what the state of the building is above you. How will they find you? Hours go by. And then you hear a tiny little skittering sound. And because it's so quiet, you notice it and you look, and coming through a pile of rocks and debris is a little cockroach with a plastic capsule on its back. It crawls out, and the little GPS light on its capsule begins to pulse. And now it's found you, and they can dig down to you and rescue you. Search and rescue gets very difficult in narrow places. And, you know, dogs are big. They have great noses. But, you know, cockroaches have really good noses, too. Scientists have tinkered with the idea of remote control insects for over a decade. This is how it works. First, you anesthetize the insect. Then you attach electrodes to its brain and sensory organs. Then the team can press a button on a remote controller to send a signal by stimulating one part of the brain to nudge the insect to turn right, to turn left, go straight ahead, even when it would normally stop. By working with the animal's natural biology, the cyborg bug requires far less computing power to operate, since it's not powered by motors and actuators that are needed for a robot. A cyborg doesn't need to carry around a battery, which could get in the way during a rescue operation. But it's not just a mindless zombie. It's actually critical that the roach maintains some level of autonomy so that it can naturally traverse objects and avoid hazardous debris. The human operator basically just makes sure it stays on path. So, for example, in a rescue situation, we only need to stimulate the cockroach to turn in its direction when it's taking the wrong way, or move when it stops unexpectedly. Osaka University roboticist Keisuke Morishima, who was not involved with the diving suit, said when he described the technology in 2023. But cyborgs also come with major downsides compared to robots. Maybe the most obvious is they need to breathe. So this severely limits the type of terrain they can access, and in the case of rescue operations, which often involve water-flooded spaces or areas with toxins in the air, it's pretty significant. So the world's first diving suit was engineered. The engineering team wanted to design a system that was lightweight, didn't require a lot of complex mechanical parts. So for the oxygen tank, I love this part, they settled on using a sponge coated with a catalyst made of magnesium dioxide. The chemical compound can slowly break down when exposed to hydrogen peroxide, which would in turn create oxygen. The oxygen released in the tank then flows into four silicon supply tubes that are attached to the roach's spiracles. Spiracles are these little holes in the edge of the thorax of a bug that let air circulate in to the gills and effectively oxygenate the blood of the insect. The roach doesn't seem to mind wearing the chunky backpack, according to the researchers. It's about 10 by 10 millimeters, by the way. So around a square garbanzo bean would be about the right size. I will point out that the article failed to interview any of the roaches involved, so we really don't know their opinion. But it's 3D printed plastic-like material, as I said, 10 by 10 millimeters, connected wirelessly to a simple controller, and the human overseer can use that to dictate the roach's movement. So they printed it together, put it together, and dropped some bugs in a maze, and it had some pitfalls and some hazardous zones, and the cyborg just did great. It could last underwater with this particular apparatus for about 3 hours compared to less than a few minutes in other circumstances. And there's a nice, it's sort of a soft silicone looks, the image of this that I have here, it looks like a large capsule that someone pulled apart and popped over the back of a cockroach, and there's a little tiny circuit board on top with connectors that presumably are going off to the battery, which you can't quite see in this image. But, you know, the idea of little autonomous things like this is just really, really intriguing. So while we're on 3D printing and futurism, 3D printing onto living tissues. In a paper published in Science Advances, a team of researchers led by Yong-Lin Kong and his colleagues at Rice University in Houston propose another application for 3D printing. They've come up with a way to print electronic circuits onto delicate materials, including living tissue. The researchers hope this could eventually lead to medical implants that wirelessly monitor the condition of their recipients, high-tech pills, and more. Now, 3D printing is not new. 3D printing circuitry is not new either. A Nano Dimension company in Massachusetts prints electronics onto communications equipment. There are printers that build antennas directly into smartphone cases and print circuits on touchscreens and solar panels. And this process uses electronic inks that contain little particles of conductive material like copper, silver, or gold. And the particles are fused together to form a conductive pathway, usually in a process called annealing, which involves either heating the whole thing in a furnace or zapping the links with a laser. But the heat needed to fuse the particles can damage sensitive materials, including polymers and living tissue. And this is the issue that Dr. Kong and his colleagues think they've overcome. They've developed a way to anneal electronic inks using microwaves focused into a beam smaller than a human hair. The precision of the beam is such that it ensures that only the ink particles heat up, avoiding any damage to the surrounding substances. And they're able to focus the beam onto a dot less than 200 millionths of a meter across. And the kit itself is really small. It can be fitted into a standard desktop 3D printer. And in addition, by adjusting the power, you can change the ultimate microstructure of the ink. So this can be used to create regions of higher or lower conductivity, so you can set up a resistor within the wiring. So it's going to be perfectly flat. So they want to use, they're using already, science is using 3D printing to make heart valves and tracheas, and also scaffoldings for ear replacement in the case of people who had a damaged ear. But if you added circuitry, you could turn these grafts into sensors. They could monitor the patient's progress in real time or even stimulate the activity of the organ they're printing on. So you could basically have a heart valve / pacemaker maybe. So they printed a strain gauge onto a cow's femur and the sorts of polymers that are used in replacement knees and hips for human patients. Another idea would be ingestible diagnostic devices. You could carefully control the release of a drug, so it wouldn't be just where the release of a drug is kind of flattened out. It would be you could just have, I can think of a patch, for example, that's just putting a very, very even amount of a drug into your body for days, maybe even. And of course, the canvas for that we have on our skin. Immediately, as I was reading this article, I started thinking about the tattoo potential. Decorative electronic tattoos. Your ring is the battery, and a little line tattooed on the back of your hand essentially takes the electricity to your forearm, and you could, I don't know, just the sky's the limit. I'm thinking about having your toes light up when you wiggle them in the dark, things like that. It's the sort of stuff that dreams are made of, and yes, my mind always does go off into a decorative direction at moments like this. But I know you can see how cool this could be. We've got time for a call if you want to make it. 831-900-5773. That's 900 KSQD. So one shot to rule them all, at least to rule all of the flu shots, maybe forever. Maybe we don't need flu vaccine anymore. Let's see how far this goes. But this one-shot flu drug, not a vaccine, solves one of the huge problems of flu shots, which is the fact that the flu's neuraminidase changing. There's two antigens, that N and H, and they change all the time. And when they change, the antibodies that we've made are shaped against those particular antigens on the surface of the flu capsid, so we can't attach to it anymore, and we get the flu even though we were vaccinated. And some years, they mess up on figuring out which vaccines to make. The typical flu shot is trivalent, and they pick the top three things that are showing up late spring in Asia, which is where the flu starts, and then hurry, make the vaccine, and then start giving it in September. This new agent had a study that enrolled 5,000 healthy adults before the flu season and followed them till after it ended. The highest dose of the drug provided 76.1% protection from flu compared with a placebo shot. Just for comparison, in terms of actual getting the flu, right? Not getting sick, but actually getting the flu. These people were being monitored to see if they got the flu. When we do that with flu vaccine, it's got around a 40 to 45% total protection rate. A lot of people still get the flu from that have had the vaccine, but they just don't get it very big. Or as our president would say, bigly. The flu shot contains a reformulated version of zanamivir. This is a flu drug known as Relenza. That may ring a bell. It's been in the market since the turn of the century and was approved to both treat and prevent disease. The problem with zanamivir or Relenza was it was an inhaler and you had to inhale it every day. It wasn't a very effective preventative drug because people just didn't want to do an inhaler every day for the entire flu season. But it was pretty effective at treating the flu. Now, it targets neuraminidase, which is on the surface of all flu viruses, and it targets it in a way that if the flu tried to mutate away from the drug to escape it, it would deactivate the neuraminidase, which is critical to the flu's ability to leave a cell that's infected. Think about this. You take over a cell, you take over its factory, you make a million copies of yourself, you take them out to the surface, but you can't launch them into the bloodstream. So you're trapped in that cell, and you can't let your babies go and go infect other cells. So you've stopped the infection in its tracks. And like I said, this works across all varieties of flu. This was the inhaled version. So Cidara, the company that we're talking about who made this thing, just developed a chemical variant, attached it to an antibody and made it resistant to being broken down in the human body. And then they took it off and gave it in the United States and the UK in 2024. And they tallied the number of participants. And that's where they got this 76% protection from placebo with the highest dose. This, as I would emphasize, this would protect against any flu, which is really huge. Actually, this was tried back in 1999 using a drug that had to be inhaled, using a nose drop. And that would also have worked. But again, getting people to do that all the time is tricky. So we're looking at a possible breakthrough that goes around the problem of the way the flu mutates and escapes our immune surveillance on a disappointingly regular annual basis. Well, that's about all for this week's podcast. Please go to AskDrDawn.com for news about our future plans. For now, this is Dr. Dawn saying so long and stay healthy.
Ask Dr. Dawn is brought to you by Jiva Media. Production and editing by Charles Mansky. Music by John Scoville.